So tonight, for this very special Saturday evening, two-part Saturday evening event, it is my great pleasure to welcome Kojin Bohanic back to Many Rivers Books and Tea. He is a very interesting man. I was going to say young, and then I stopped myself, but compared to me, he's definitely young. And but he's done a lot in those few years. Sonoma Yoga Martial Arts is the company that he has founded and run for many years. He has also been a student of Sanskrit at the University of California, Berkeley for 5 years. He's in the, a graduate student at the Institute of Buddhist Studies at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. So he has been looking at the Mahabharata for many years and related literature, and we are just ecstatic to have him here with us tonight. So glad, and please help me welcome Kojin Bohanic.
All right, thank you all for coming tonight. I'm glad that you all made it. First and foremost, I'd like to thank Jim and Stuart and Rob for having me here. It's such a pleasure to come to Many Rivers. I really love this bookstore. If you guys do not shop here, you should shop here as often as you can. I really believe that it's the best bookstore in the North Bay, and I pick up a lot of material here. That being said, over there you can see some Bhagavad Gitas and some Mahabharatas that you can purchase if you'd like. All of these are very, very excellent copies. I particularly like that that second one there. That's Tripurari Swami Bhagavad Gita. I consult that one pretty frequently myself, and I really enjoy that one. So, you know, please make sure that you patronize this wonderful establishment, and thank you guys for having me here as well, too. And then also I'd like to say thanks to all my teachers who have taught me all that I've been studying for the last few years. And I just want to say that any errors that I make, this is a very confusing, as you're about to find out, subject, and any errors that I make, I assure you, are my own, and they don't reflect, you know, what my teachers have taught me. So let's get that qualification out of the way, okay? So the Mahabharata, I'm not really sure what you guys may or may not know about this. We have a very mixed level group here. Some people know a lot of it. Other people may have never even heard of it, or maybe only just be hearing about it for the first time. I will say that the most confusing thing about this subject matter is the lineage and the names of all the people involved, okay? So I would like to encourage you guys to ask questions if you would like. Let's try not to get into two major philosophical discourses, as the storyline has to keep moving along as much as possible. However, one question that I would like to hear from you guys very frequently is, who is that again? Because and then I will go over here and I'll go, oh, well, yeah, Chitrangad, he is this guy, and Dukkadaspa is this, you know, so This is I've hung this here for a reason. This is just kind of part of the story. The story really hinges around this kind of lineage and these interrelations between every person here has got their own myth and their own complex story, and they all kind of mash together and create this kind of cacophony of mythology that's just really overwhelming and driving towards this really catastrophic event. So the Mahabharata war is the war that happens at Kurukshetra approximately 5,000 years ago, about 3,000 before the Common Era. This is a mythological time. I do wear two hats, multiple hats, many hats, actually. My personal identity is very complex and a hybridized sense of religious and academic identity. So I do wear various different hats. Sometimes I'm a Buddhist, sometimes I'm a Hindu, sometimes I'm an academic, sometimes I'm a practitioner. So I'll be a little schizophrenic when I'm talking to you. I will say, well, the academic perspective is this. Well, from a traditionalist perspective, it's going to be like this. From, you know, maybe a Vaishnava perspective, it may be like this. So I may do that a lot, and so that's our modern world, where we're lucky enough to live in a world where identity is not really delimited by geography as much as it has been in the past. So we can have these really complex identities, and it's a beautiful time to be alive because of that. So the Mahabharata war is one of the Mahabharata itself is it's one of two major Indian epics, early Sanskrit epics, right? The first one being the Ramayana, which is the story of Rama, and the Mahabharata we could say is the story of Krishna, right? So these are the avatars; these are the gods that have descended down. They are said to be incarnations of the Lord Vishnu on our planet, right? The first one being Rama, and then the next one in this story is Krishna. He's the main god. And he's got a very complex divine identity himself in this story, as we will see, you know. So that's what the Mahabharata is, and it becomes a very, very seminal, central work in Indian Sanskrit literature. And then the mythology in it is immense. it's often, there's a common refrain that's used that says something to the effect of, whatever that exists is in the Mahabharata. Anything that is not in here does not exist. You know, I mean, it's got an encyclopedic nature about it. By its own identifying itself as a text, it's just this incredible volume of everything that's in there, as you're about to hear. So hopefully I'll try to talk slowly and not overwhelm with too much information. So the first thing that I would like to start talking about is the context of the Mahabharata. You know, I'll get into the storyline a little bit, but I find it to be really interesting to know about the context. And so I started with my amazing cartography skills over here. In case you can't tell what this is the Indian subcontinent. And I was pretty impressed that Rob was able to identify that immediately. So the historical backdrop, so we have a mythological history, and we also have a historical, like what we get from archaeology, etc. And they actually kind of correspond to some degree. There's a traditional perspective that really resents the idea of the Aryan migrations, that is to say that the Aryans brought Sanskrit from elsewhere to the Indian subcontinent. But then that's the academic perspective, is that, and that's what I'll start by representing. I'll start with the academic perspective. Is that up here, where the Dia de los Muertos guys are, over here you can see this is the plains of Asia, right? We have the Caucasus Mountains, the Caspian Sea, the Black Sea, etc. And you have a group of people who were nomadic pastoralists who lived up here, a very patriarchal society whose religious practice was that of a fire oblation, a fire ritual offering practice. Their identity with divinity was of a trade relationship, right? And they brought down, they started to migrate about 3200, about 1600 before the Common Era. They started coming in through the plains of Asia, or excuse me, to this Indian subcontinent, right? There was already a group of people here in the Indus Valley, right? Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa, that were agrarian community of people with highly standardized systems of units and measurements, probably indicative of a highly centralized structure, government and society, very amazing society, and they interacted, and we don't really know what the interaction consisted of. It used to be thought of as an Aryan invasion, but that's, you know, now no longer in favor in the academic community. Now it's thought of as more of a migration. But for one reason or another, the Indus Valley people started to decline, and the Aryan Sanskrit people bringing the Vedic material started to proliferate. Right, and for a gradual period of time, they started moving this direction. They came in contact with the central Gangetic plain here, the Ganges, and they slowly moved out towards here, Bay of Bengal over here, and Bengal right over here. So that's where the Vedic people, and this is really the story of the Aryan migration here. So these little names right here, we can call these Mahajana Padas, right? Janapada means like the place where the people are, right? This is where the people settle, right? And there's a third interacting community here of people is the indigenous population there. You know, you could call them Dravidians, but the people who were there before, probably characterized by nature worship, a lot of tree worship, and we still hear their voice in the Sanskrit literature, particularly when you start hearing about yakshasas and these kind of nature spirits, particularly oriented around trees and that sort of thing. So their voice still is in the literature, and you can still hear their voices. And so various different things started to happen, and I think we could do a left-to-right sort of thing here. This area right here, the Kuru Panchala, became known as much more Vedic orthodoxy, I guess you could say conservative, much more rigid sort of ideas of who were Aryan and who were not, who were noble and who were not, versus over here, things were a lot more mixed up. And there was a lot more kind of multi-practice sort of thing. So the story that we're talking about here is the interaction right here, and then of course this leads to the Chandragupta Maurya, right, and the Mauryan Empire starts to come out of all of this as well too. Right here, oh my gosh, did I leave out Magadha? Okay, Magadha is right here. Magadha is probably the most important. I didn't put it up there. I'll have to remember to put that. But Magadha starts to expand and starts to take over its neighbors. And all of these places start getting absorbed by Magadha, and then this turns into the Mauryan Empire, which then, of course, interacts with Alexander the Great when he comes down. Okay, so this is kind of the backdrop, the historical backdrop, these interactions between these communities of people. And when we hear the stories and the mythology of the Mahabharata, this is what we're listening to. Maybe from a, I guess you could say, historical perspective. We're listening to, because the story is the tensions that are happening between these different regions and these different places. And for me, I like to really, like when I talk about a place, like we're going to talk about Mathura and Dwaraka, particularly in relationship to the Lord Krishna, right? And it's really nice to actually have a spot on the map here where this is happening, okay? And so anyway, this is the historical backdrop, we could say, for the Mahabharata. So the Vedic period, the time when this migration is happening, the orthodoxy of the Vedas, like I said, they're fire oblation, ritual offering of fire, a reciprocal relationship with divinity. I do something for the God does something for me, characterized by major gods such as Soma, Indra, Agni, etc. So these are kind of the Vedic gods, right? And they're huge and they're supreme and they're the highest form of divinity during the Vedic period. Post-Vedic period, they start to diminish, and other gods start to rise. And this is a constant cycle that's happening all the time in world history. It's lovely to watch how some divinities go down, others rise up, they change into other divinities, they travel over here. You can see our friend Zeus over here, cognate with the word Gyaus. Gyaus is one of the Vasus, who becomes an incarnation, punished to be born in this terrible Bhuloka, this awful human earth, as Bhishma, okay? So cognate with Gyaus turns into Zeus, and then Jupiter, right? So he's actually related because they have an earlier ancestry, which that's where I'm going to stop talking about that subject so I don't go on forever. So anyway, the Vedas had this sort of thing, and the Vedic gods are diminishing. And then the post-Vedic period starts to happen, even though the Upanishads, see, there's layers of text. There's the four Vedas. Then there's the Aranyakas, the Brahmanas, and then the Upanishads. And they're a commentary on a commentary on a commentary, telling you how to do rituals, things like this. Then the Upanishads start suddenly getting very, very philosophical. And there's one of the processes that starts happening, as we were talking about earlier today, is the internalization of ritual, right? So before, the ritual was literally, you do something for God, God does something for you. And then that starts to get interpreted a little bit differently, and that now this ritual has significance, but it also represents an internal mental process as well. And that's one of the hallmarks of the post-Vedic, the transition. So you have certain gods diminishing, certain gods increasing, and you have this new orientation to looking at the Vedic ritual. Also within the Upanishads start coming new ideas, such as transmigration, karma, reincarnation, some people call that, the idea that you're born and you're dying, and also the idea that life sucks. That starts to really happen, and that we don't want to be reborn in this crappy place anymore. You know, that starts to really become the hallmark of the post-Vedic period, that we don't want to keep being reborn in here. We need to free ourselves. We need to do something so that we're not going to keep being reborn in these awful, terrible places, you know. I guess maybe it reflects the pessimism of the time. The idea is that you get moksha. You liberate yourself from this. So this becomes more of the spiritual quest. So it's no longer that I'm going to do something nice to attain a place in Svarga, right, in heaven. Right? I'm going to propitiate my ancestors, and then my son, it has to be a son, will propitiate me when I'm dead, and therefore I will get my place in Svarga. It's not so much concern. And then what happens in Svarga? Svarga is like, heaven is like, this place only like way more awesome. You know, like the cows are bigger, the women are nicer, better tequila or whatever. You know, Svarga is this like really awesome place. And that was kind of the idea, right? But now it's kind of like, the idea starts getting, well, you can get reborn into these higher heavenly realms. However, you still have karma up there. And you're going to get a little arrogant, and you're going to get a little proud, and you get a little comfortable, and all those things are going to create some karma that's going to make you back down in the hell realms again, and you're just going to keep spinning around over and over, out of control, until you find the right spiritual journey that's going to liberate you from this process. So these are sort of the ideas that are starting to happen, and we can see this in the Mahabharata. In the Mahabharata, it's a compendium, right? It mentions all of these sort of things, you know. The yajna, the sacrifice, is well-respected. The characters do Ashmaveda, the horse sacrifice. They do Rajasuya sacrifice. They do many of these Vedic sacrifices. But then there's also these other elements, too. These elements of moksha and stuff like this. And then, the novel god Krishna, right, coming down as the incarnation of Vishnu. Vishnu was a very, very small god in the Vedic material, I think mentioned only a couple times in the Rig Veda, and he was kind of like helping Indra, but then all of a sudden he gets a life of his own, as was Rudra. Rudra was kind of like this outsider, kind of gnarly god who you didn't really like him that much. He was kind of responsible for all these bad things, and if you didn't want bad things to happen, you prayed to him because he was the bad thing god. But then all of a sudden he turns into Shiva, which, you know, he gets called actually Shiva in the Rig Veda, which means like benevolent one, right? And then all of a sudden he starts taking on this form too. And then we have the emergence of the three main cults of Hinduism in terms of maybe theological cults. We have Vaishnavism, Shaktiism, and Shaivism, right? The emergence of the Shakti cult, the cult of the goddess, the cult of Vishnu, and the cult of Shiva, right? And this is also, again, what's represented here. So what you'll find in a lot of the literature is this constant putting down of the old Vedic gods. Like Indra, oh yeah, yeah, he's just helping out so-and-so. Or, you know, there's, you know, examples of even the Buddha showing Indra up. And so poor little Indra just gets kicked around in all this post-Vedic material. And it's kind of sad because he was at one point the supreme god of, you know. And so, you know, you see this happening and then the other gods are emerging as well, too. So this is part of our historical backdrop. So much for the chair. Huh? Also what's happening with this as well is there's a certain degree of urbanization that's happening. People are getting more sedentary and more stable, and that's creating stratification. So what happens is people stop going from nomadic pastoralists. They start doing agriculture. You can't wander around when you're doing agriculture. You've got to be in the same place. It also creates surplus. So people get more stagnant in the same place. They create larger communities. There's surplus that creates more wealth. That allows for a caste of society to, or I should say a class of society, to be able to benefit off of the work of others and to be able to pursue more intellectual pursuits. And again, all of this is reflected in this literature as well, too. You can start seeing the cities and, you know, we have Hastinapura, which, oh my goodness, I didn't put that up there either. And then Indraprastha. I was really, like, going fast when I made this map. In case you can't tell. So anyway, this is kind of the world that's going on, this world of the Mahajanapadas and the interaction with them, the Aryan migration, the descent of the Vedic culture, and the rising of the new post-Vedic material. Okay, so that's what's going on with that. Okay, so the mythological world of the Mahabharata. So Mahabharata is considered itihasa, right? Itihasa means something like that it was said. You know, I mean, it's literally, it views itself as history. Right, and there's a specific date, you know, of the when the war ended, 3102 before the Common Era. You know, there's specific dates, and it's considered something that did happen. So these are the lineage, and the people today in India, a lot of them will trace their lineage to all kinds of characters in Mahabharata. You know, even some of them less desirable characters, they'll say, oh yeah, we're related to them. So it really does see itself as itihasa, that is to say, a historical account of what's happening, right? Okay, so another pretty major backdrop that we have here is the Hindu, I should say maybe the Puranic understanding of time. Now, this is represented in a lot of this post-Vedic material, and there's a lot of conflicting numbers. One of my professors did his PhD dissertation on this, and I'm basically reflecting this basically how he told me, but he also warned me that the numbers don't always add up. Okay, so you can see that we have several cycles of time here. We have the Manvantaras. Oh, so this is to say that time is cyclic, right? It's not like a linear time. So as the Aryans were coming down into the subcontinent, some of them stayed in India, but some of them moved over to Iran, right? The word Iran comes from Aryan, right? And they started taking a different take on things. So they have the same ancestors. But in Iran, they started coming up with this idea of like a teleological end to time. Like it's going to keep going and keep going, and there's just going to be a catastrophic event, and it's then it's going to be over, right? Well, over in India, the idea becomes cyclic. The time is constantly contraction, expansion, by one reckoning with the breath of Vishnu, right? Vishnu exhales, everything created. Inhales, everything destroyed, right? And that's Vishnu, right? Out of Vishnu's navel, has anybody seen Narayana up here somewhere? I know you have Narayana up here. Maybe not. Okay, out of Vishnu's navel is coming a lotus flower, and sitting on the lotus flower is the god Brahma, the god of creation of the universe. So Brahma opens his eyes, he creates things, but he's preserved by Vishnu, the sleeping Narayana, the sleeping Vishnu god, So who's breathing and creating destruction. So. But this is a Vaishnava reckoning of things, you know, where everything kind of comes out of Vishnu. So you can tell whose voice I'm using by who, you know, if I start talking about, you know, Shiva as being the cosmic destroyer like he is in the Nataraj. Got to be here somewhere too, right? Anyway.
Nataraj.
Right.
Is that behind you?
Oh, no.
Okay. I can only see a little bit of it.
Creation, destruction of the universe. You know, that would be more of a Shaivite sort of thing. But anyway, so out of the navel of Vishnu comes Brahma, the creator god, right? And and he's constantly creating universes in this sort of cycle, right? The first one is called the Manvantara, right? This is the age of Manu. Manu is kind of the equivalent of Adam, right? Adam and Eve, if you will. The first man, right? Created from the sun god, you know, with several, four other brothers and sisters. And then he becomes the one to offer the first sacrifice to his older brother, Yama, who dies. And because Yama is the first person to die, Manu offers a sacrifice to him, and then Yama becomes the god of death. So he's the one who shows you on the other side, who teaches you where to go, because he went first. So it's natural that he's our guru, right? He's the one who goes before, right? So this is about 308 million years. These numbers are going to get gigantic here in a minute. And we do happen to have a PhD in mathematics in the front row right here to help us figure out, though she's often insisting that she doesn't know anything about arithmetic. So Mahayuga is made up of four small yugas. Kṛta, Treta, Dvapara, Kali. Kṛta is also called Satya, right? Kṛta Yuga, 1 million, 1.7, 1.2, 864,000, Dvapara, 432 for Kali, okay? The whole thing adds up to roughly 4.32 million years, okay? So this is the Mahayuga. It's a cycle of this. This is a descending cycle of Dharma. Dharma we can refer to. The term has a very complicated history, but for now let's just call it righteousness. Okay. So what the parable is that there's a Dharma cow who's standing on four legs, and in the Kṛta Yuga, the age of righteousness, he's standing all four. She, if it's a cow, I suppose, standing on all four legs. Right. Well established in Dharma. And then Trita, cow is on three legs. Vapara, now cow is on two legs. And Kali Yuga, now we have the cow on one leg. That is to say, the people are not very righteous in this particular time. The Mahabharata war, when 3102 happens, that is marking the beginning of the dreaded, awful Kali Yuga. So we've been in Kali Yuga for about 5,000 years now. So it looks like we only have about 427,000 years of this crap before we're done, okay? So that's it. Then everything's good. And then it goes back to Kṛta, too. We don't have to climb back up. So the good news is it goes right back to Kṛta. So anyway, so this is your Mahayugas, right? Mahayugas form a Kalpa, right? Kalpa is 4.32 billion years. So 1,000 Mahayugas equals 1 Mahakalpa. Also 14 Manvantaras. This reckoning right here, I think, is based off of this number, but you'll often see this is 311 or 312 million years. That number changes, but basically it's about 1,400 Manvantaras. Okay, so you can see how these cycles are changing all the time. So now this becomes mythologized to the life of Brahma, right? Brahma, the creator god, again, coming out of Narayana's navel. And let me be clear that Narayana and Vishnu are basically different names for the same god. Narayana is cognate with Orion. So Brahma is said to live 100 years of his years, right? In his years, that's basically about 311 trillion plus 40 billion years, right? So Brahma's kind of an old dude. So one day of Brahma is two kalpas, right? So that's two of these guys right here, right? So 4.32 times 2, 8-ish, something.
8.64.
What's it?
8.64.
I thought you didn't know arithmetic. So
you do have it up there.
Oh, do I have it? I cheated. Okay. So, and then 1 month is 30 of these days. That's to say 60 kalpas. 1 year is 360 days. That's to say 720 of these guys. And then the Mahabharata, right now, they, according to the reckoning of the Mahabharata, 50 years have passed since this universe has been created. So that's 50 times 4.32 billion. That makes the universe about 216 billion years old by the Mahabharata's reckoning. And according to the science, scientific understanding of things, astrophysics, we have the Earth at about 4.54 billion, and we have the entire universe at about 13.78. So 216 billion years, according to Mahabharata, 13. So you can see how the universe is considerably older based on the Mahabharata's reckoning of things. But what I find interesting about that is not the comparison of one being more accurate than the other. I don't find that interesting at all. What I do find interesting is the large volumes of time that these ancient systems have of speculating about, right? I mean, here our universe, you know, we can only go back 13.78 billion years, and nobody even wants to think about pre-Big Bang, you know? They just don't even want to think about it, you know? But here you have these, like, what's that?
There's partial destructions at the ends of days, so it all works out.
Oh, it all, right. So, but according to these numbers, you know, like, for example, in the Ramayana, how many monkeys show up to fight Ravana? 10 to the 37th power. I mean, well, that's a huge number, you know? Like, I mean, they have these gigantic numbers that they're calculating them. I mean, it's like, you know, this is a complex mathematics. Actually, I had a tutor when I lived in India, or when I was staying in India and I was studying. He was getting his PhD in ancient mathematics. He was dealing with a lot of stuff very easy. Okay, and then the last thing that I'm going to say is there's innumerable Brahmins, right? There's Brahmas, right? So Brahma, there's not just one. There's millions of them, right? Billions of them. Innumerable. We're not sure if it's immeasurable, innumerable, or infinite, but there's a whole lot of them, right? That's to say, okay, Vanna? Her name's not really Vanna.
Anybody want to buy a vowel?
You just bought an incense holder. Good. So one of the things that makes the Mahabharata such a terrible migraine to study is this idea of kind of narrative framing.
Inception.
What's that?
It's like Inception.
How so? Is that the movie?
Yeah, there's many levels.
Oh, yeah. So like you can have a dream within a dream within a dream within a dream within a dream, right? This is kind of what's happening here, right? Welcome, Ananta. How are you? So right here, the outermost level of the framing starts off with the story of Prithivi, the Earth Mother, right? She's being ravaged by these demonic asuras, right? So the whole universe is conceived as this cosmic battle between the devas and the asuras, right? The gods and the... And we're going to go with anti-gods, right? Because, you know, demons doesn't quite work. They're technically actually related. I think they're cousins, you can see. But they're... And then also in the early Vedic material, the asuras and the devas were not, I guess you could say, by a moral scale, that far apart, you know? But they started getting more polarized as the literature goes on, to the point where you see this universe as being this cosmic battle between the devas and the asuras. And what are they mostly fighting for? Amrita, right? The nectar of immortality, right? So you have this beautiful iconography of the Kurma avatar of Vishnu, where he comes down as a turtle to assist in the cosmic churning of the cosmic ocean, where they basically put a turning pestle thing and wrap a snake around it, and the devas get on one side, the asuras get on the other side, and the gods and the anti-gods churn the cosmic ocean like you're making butter, and all of creation comes out of this, and they're particularly looking for this Amrita, right? Amrita comes out, long story, gods, they're no longer cooperating, they take it from the asuras, from the anti-gods, and take off with it, spills in four different places. This is the locations of the Kumbh Mela. Right, so the outermost framing is this idea of this war, this cosmic war that we're all part of. That's the good and evil, I suppose you could say. You know, and you know, you could see the prophet Mani. You know, many of you know the term Manichaeism, right? You say like George Bush, you're either with us or you're against us. We're good, they're evil. That's Manichaean point of view. Well, the prophet Mani was likely influenced by these sort of ideas as well, too. That's the outermost. So what happens is this: the Earth Mother Prithivi is being ravaged by these asuras who keep getting reborn into her realm, and they're creating this disaster mess as kshatriyas. They come down to become warriors, right? Or power holders, I suppose. You know, people who are in charge of state and king and royally, the kind of kshatriya class, and they're just ravaging the earth, right? And so Prithivi comes to the gods and she says, you know, you guys got to help me out here and get rid of these asuras, you know, extermination, and the gods are all like, oh, what are we going to do? We don't know what to do. We better go to the awesome god and see what Vishnu has to say about this. So they all approach Vishnu, and they say, Vishnu, what are you going to do to help? And Vishnu's like, okay, I'll go down and I'll take care of it, right? And so in this outermost framing of the story, you have this cosmic battle between the devas and the asuras, and the story is that Vishnu is now going to come down to intercede, to exterminate the asuras, okay? So... Mahabharata is a very genocidal book. There's three main holocausts that are happening in the book, and I'll point those out. But it's pretty brutal and it's pretty bloody, And sometimes the heroes do not always behave like heroes. It's actually it's one of the interesting things about, like, Shastraic literature does this too, where they just throw all the ideas in there, and they tell you everything not to do and then tell you how to do it, you know, or they have this moral grayness about them that I think in our Western world we're used to more sententious texts like the Bible, thou shall not, thou shall not, thou shall not. We're comfortable with that. It's easy. We don't have to think. We just do whatever it says, you know. Very easy. However, not to put down the Bible, though, you know, of course, but I'm just saying that I think we're a little bit more comfortable with that sort of thing versus a literature where everything is morally gray and good guys are doing these horrible things and horrible people are actually making arguments about what the moral thing is to do. And I think it, the reader gets a little sort of uneasiness about this, you know. I certainly do. And you'll see, I actually sympathize with the villains a lot. I mean, I really do. Maybe even more so than I do for the heroes in some cases, as you're going to see, because they actually make a pretty good case for why they're doing what they're doing. But we'll get to that. So anyway, you have this Devasura war going on, right? And that's the cosmic background. Vishnu is going to come down to be reborn as Krishna, whereupon he's going to help exterminate, basically, the Asuras. Again, that to me is a little uncomfortable, but that's the feeling, in order to help the Earth Mother, right? So, that's it. Okay. So, the next layer of framing here is this Vyasa and Ganesha story, right? So, Vyasa's narrating the story to Ganesha, right? And Vaishampayana is listening, okay? So, Vaishampayana becomes one of the main people for the next frame, right? So basically, Brahma requests that Vyasa ask Ganesha to write it down. Just he does so with the tusk. And there's a certain story about, like, I'll do it if you don't stop writing. And he says, well, I'll do that if you don't stop talking. So they're kind of like tricking each other and stalling at various times. And so this narration of the next level of framing of the story would be that Vyasa is narrating the story to Ganesha, right? But then within that story, again, like I said, it's like having a dream within a dream within a dream within. Within that layer of the story, you have Janamejaya and Vaishampayana. Vaishampayana is the student of Vyasa, listens to this, and then he narrates it to Janamejaya, okay? So this is where we start going crazy with lineage. Do I have Janamejaya up here? No, yeah, right there, okay? So we're kind of starting at the bottom here, right? Janamejaya. So what happened before Janamejaya, right? All the way back to there. Let's start with him.
Your position is sort of suboptimal because you're blocking for some.
Suboptimal.
Okay.
I'm
not gonna say that. It goes against my Balkan blood. I like.
What's the mouse in Ganesh?
The what?
It's always a mouse in Ganesh.
What I've been explained is that he's a rat, and it represents prosperity. You know, like, if you're prosperous, you have a lot of grain and things sitting around, you tend to see rats, right? And we're like, bubonic plague! But that's kind of like more like, it represents that. So this is Vahana, his vehicle, right? You know, all these deities are often represented with a deity. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay, sure. So Janamejaya, again, here's the story from Vaishampayana, okay? So who's Janamejaya? Janamejaya is in the context of our very first holocaust, right? It's the Sarpameda Yajna. Janamejaya is trying to exterminate all of the Naga race. The Naga race are a race of serpent beings, right? And there's speculation that they may actually have been a tribe of people that may have indigenous people who are conflicting with the kind of various migrations and things that were happening in this the Vedicization of the northern part of the subcontinent. That may be what they were. We're not really sure. They have an ambiguous role in the literature. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. You know, like you have Sesha, who's I'm still always looking for his Narayana. He's here, I can feel him. Anyway, the Sesha, the cosmic serpent that the sleeping Vishnu lays upon. He's a serpent, right? And then his little brother is Takshaka, who ends up, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. So Janamejaya, his father is Parikshit. Okay? Parikshit is the son of Abhimanyu.
Abhimanyu is the son of Arjuna. Let me know when the names start sounding familiar. Okay, good. So Arjuna Uvacha, right? So this is our Arjuna from the beloved Bhagavad Gita, right? Arjuna and Krishna having a discourse on Dharma on the battlefield just before the battle begins, right? So Arjuna's son, Abhimanyu, dies in the war. Parikshit almost destroyed, his name means destroyed, almost gets destroyed in the war. And then he has a son, Janamejaya. So Janamejaya becomes the lineage holder for the Pandavas, and after the war, he's really the only guy who survives, right? Everybody else has these very kind of sad endings. So Parikshit is saved, right? So Abhimanyu is killed by Ashwatthama, the son of Drona. Again, some of these names might get a little bit fuzzy. I'm saying a lot of these just for people who are familiar with the names. Parikshit, there's a particular part of the battle where Ashwatthama deploys a certain weapon called the Brahmashira's weapon, right? And he directs it at Abhimanyu's wife, Uttara, and she's pregnant with Parikshit. And Parikshit is destroyed. That's hence the name. Right? He's killed. He dies. But then Krishna intervenes and helps him live, right? So then Parikshit becomes the last surviving member of this whole thing, right? Parikshit, again, the father of Janamejaya. This is kind of like, dang, I should have put them on the same side. Parikshit, again, the father of Janamejaya, he dies himself, right? And the whole reason why Janamejaya is doing this holocaust to kill all the Nagas is to because of revenge against what happened to his father, Parikshit. His father, Parikshit, one day while out hunting, which is how all the kings get into trouble, by the way. If you hear a story begin, one day there was a king out hunting, something bad is sure to happen. Right? So one day Parikshit is out hunting, right? And I guess he's lost, and so he comes across an ashram where there's a Brahmin sitting there meditating, and says, "Hey, yo, you know where I'm at? Where am I at?" And the Brahmin's just meditating, just totally in his trance. And he kind of gets mad, so he picks up a dead snake and throws it around his neck. And he's like, "Ah, screw you," and kind of walks off, kind of really cocky. Well, the son of that rishi, or the son of that sage, sees this interaction. And he gets upset, you know, disrespecting my father. "Well, I'm going to curse you because you put a dead snake on my father while he was meditating. You're going to die of a snake bite." Okay? And so he becomes cursed. And you don't mess with anybody who does any kind of austerity, living in the forest, practicing asceticism. Those people have power, right? And they like to use that power to curse people. No, to give boons and to give curses. So you get a lot of cursing going on in this literature. So anyway, what happens is Parikshit becomes cursed, right? And he begs. He says, "Oh no, please don't do this to me. I don't want to do it." And he says, "Okay." And usually what happens when somebody curses you, if you just fall on the floor and beg, they can't take their word back. But they can add an amendment, right? So what if you just got to negotiate your way through these things, right? And so Parikshit, "Please don't kill me." He says, okay, look, here's what's going on. If you can survive for 1 year, then you won't die. But if you can, if you die, but you know, you have to survive a year, and then this curse won't work, okay? And so Parikshit goes through this extraordinary thing of trying to isolate himself from the world and stay away from everything, and he gets very, very cocky on the last day.
Oh.
He decides, "I made it, I'm going to live, this is great. Screw that guy, I'm alive," right? And this is basically how he is. And then somebody brings him a plate of food, he picks up the food, he takes a bite, and a little, it's kind of described as like a worm bites him, but it wasn't just a worm, it was a snake. It was a little snake, and this snake has history, okay, as you may expect. This is Takshaka, right? Takshaka, again, he's the brother of Sesha, you know, the cosmic serpent. He lives in a place called the Kandava forest, and he's mad. He's really mad. He doesn't even know about this Brahman, his son, and the curse. He doesn't know anything about that. He just knows that he doesn't like these Kuru kings. You know, I call these guys Kurus because they're all kind of related from this dude right here. Okay, so these guys are all Kurus, right? So he doesn't like these Kuru kings because of our friend Arjuna and Krishna, actually, incidentally. At a certain point, these guys were clearing a forest, clear cut in the forest as a favor to Agni, the fire god, defying Indra. And they burn, again, this is another, this actually isn't one of the major holocausts, but it's pretty horrific. They burn down the entire forest and everything in it dies, with the exception of Maya, right? Maya is the architect of the gods, Asura Maya. And Takshaka, his family lives in this kind of a forest, and his wife and his son die in this process. So he's got a vendetta against the Kuru kings. And he's decided that these Kuru kings are no good and I'm going to go after them. And that's why he ends up sneaking into the food and killing him. But that also was a fulfillment of the prophetic curse. So anyway, that was a lot of time for the first page of this. So Janamejaya, the son of Partichit, the guy who just got killed by the snake bite, is mad. You know, he's not going to just let this go. He wants to exterminate these Nagas once and for all. So he goes about with this Sarva Meda, which is a horrific ceremony in which the Nagas are compelled to just jump in the fire. It kind of like summons them, and they just are jumping in the fire and burning alive. And it's very, very, very sad. But it does get broken up. One particular Brahmin's mother is a Naga, and he comes to Janamejaya and he begs for mercy. He says, please don't kill them all, don't kill them all. You know, my family is, you know. And Janamejaya, being a king, is being a kshatriya. You know, he's partial to mercy. You know, to be a dharmic king, he has to show mercy. So he ends up stopping the Sarva Meda, and the snakes actually, some of them live. And then that actually ends the animosity between them. Okay, Nana? So that's the, oh, sorry, that's the outermost framing of the story. So what's happening here is Janamejaya is doing the sacrifice to kill all the snakes. As part of the sacrifice, he has to know his family history. And so he turns to Vaishampayana, and he says, Vaishampayana, tell me about my family. And he says, I'm glad you're asked. Now the whole story of the Mahabharata is a conversation between Vyasa having Ganesha dictate it, and then Vaishampayana telling it to Janamejaya. This is the framing. Okay, and then within that, and then within that. So you'll be reading along in the Mahabharata, and you'll suddenly be like, Vaishampayana Uvacha? Who's Vaishampayana? Why is this guy talking? This is a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Who's this guy Vaishampayana, right? Well, it's because he's been narrating. So, you know, you'll suddenly get these, you know, so-and-so Uvacha, somebody or so says something, and you're kind of like, who is this guy? And you kind of got to go back to your mythical narrative and go, okay, well, this person's telling this person. And then within the story, somebody will start telling somebody else's story, and somebody will start telling somebody else's story. And this will happen many, many, many times to the point where you're just pulling your hair out trying to figure out what's going on. And so if you're feeling a little confused, then I must be doing a good job. Okay, so a lot of this stuff hinges around lineage. We have Yayati up at the top. So we just did the bottom. Now we're going to do the top, and then we're going to fill in the middle. Okay? So the story of Yayati. Yayati is a king in Hastinapura, right here. Okay, this is the main area. I can't believe I didn't write that up there. Okay, well, imagine this.
No,
what's that?
No,
you can, like kind of.
You're being discriminative about what you're.
Okay. Well, Hastinapura, that's kind of the main city here. Okay, this is the main locus of action, right? And Yayati is he's a king in this area. As you can see, he's a little bit distant back from our heroes here. These are our heroes, the Pandavas. These are our villains right here. Okay, so he's a little bit farther back in time. And I'm just doing this to explain how Krishna came about, right? So this is remember today in class we said something like we came across Yadava. Right, and I said, oh, I'm going to explain that in the talk. So this is that part, the Yadava, right? So Yayati is a king, and he marries a woman by the name of Devayani. Yayati is a king. He's a kshatriya. He marries Devayani, who is Brahmin, right? A priest. This is what's called a pratiloma marriage. This is against the grain. You know, there's anuloma, pratiloma, you know, veloma. With the grain, it's okay for a woman to marry somebody of a higher caste. But it's not okay for a woman to marry somebody of a lower caste. And in this literature, because this is very Brahmin-centric literature, the Brahmins are considered to be higher than the Kshatriyas. The priest caste is considered higher than the warrior caste. So she was a Brahmin and she married down into a warrior caste. Okay, this is, as far as we know, this is the only time in the literature where that happens. Right, so this is a little counter-normative, but anyway, that's a little pedantic. So Devyani has a father who's named Shukracharya, right? He's the Brahmin father. They fall in love. Dayati Devyani, long story short, is a dowry present. The king gives Sharmistra as a dowry gift to the Yayati. So Yayati's now got this wife, but then he's also got this, like, you know, maid gift, and with the instructions that whatever you do, you never sleep with her, right? You only sleep with my with my daughter, right? So basically, Shukracharya gives her that with that qualification, okay? So King Yayati has two kids with Devayani. Notice the first one, Yadu. I underlined the important one. And then with Sharmistra, he kind of goes behind everybody's back and decides he's just going to have three kids with her. No big deal, right? And then, of course, what happens is Devayani finds out. She goes to her daddy and says, Shukracharya, look what this jerk did. And he gets cursed, right? Again, so a lot of curses, always curses, right? So he gets cursed. He says, okay, now, since you screwed around on my daughter, you are going to become old before your time. You are going to be an old man, okay? And Yayati, being a very vain king, is like, no, don't do that to me. And he says, please, no, falls on his floor begging, please don't do this to me, don't do this. And of course, Shukracharya is like, well, okay. If you can get one of your sons to exchange this curse with you, you can have your son's youth, and they will get the old age. And Yayati's like, cool. So he's like, I got hella sons. I'm just going to go ask them all, right? Hey, Yadu, what do you say? You helped the old man out. And Yadu's like, screw you, Pops, which is very something you're not supposed to do. I mean, your parents are like gods to you, right? You're supposed, whatever they say, you do without hesitation. Yadu, all of these guys know. But then Puru becomes the one who's like, doesn't even question. Okay, sure, you give it to me, right? And so Puru inherits the throne. These guys get banished into exile because they're bad kids. So let's see if I have a quote here from Yayati that I really love. Okay, so Yayati lives thousands and thousands of years. People lived a long time back then. Lots of wheatgrass. Went to the gym every morning. And he lives thousands of years. And then he just kind of comes to this conclusion. He says, know this for certain. Not all the food, wealth, and women of this world can appease the lust of a single man of uncontrolled senses. Craving for sense pleasures is not removed by aggravated by indulgence, even as ghee is poured on the fire increases it. One who aspires for peace and happiness should instantly renounce craving and seek that which never grows old, nor ceases even when the body ages, i.e. the atma, the self. So he comes to this conclusion that, you know, being young is overrated, okay? A man of uncontrolled passions, it doesn't really matter. You never get enough. It doesn't matter. You could die, you know. But if you can control your passions, it doesn't matter how long you live, because you've got this inner realization that's unaffected by external circumstances. So I really like his moral lesson here. And then he goes back to Puru and says, you know, Puru, let's trade back. And Puru then becomes the young guy, and Yayati goes off and dies. Nina! Oh, sorry. Wait, I guess one more thing. I keep getting that to you. You look like you need to stretch your legs. So the Yadava lineage becomes this this other lineage. These guys are banished, right? So Yadu gets banished over to Mathura, right? And then around here, this is where he starts the Yadava lineage, right? Of which Krishna is a descendant, okay? So Krishna is related to the people of Hastinapura. That's all these guys who are our main characters. He's basically a distant, you know, cousin of some sort, right? They go trace back to the Yayati, okay? So this is where Krishna falls in, and where the Hastinapura kings, the Kuru kings, fallen, okay? Because you have Kuru, or Kuru, actually. He's right there. He goes to Kuru after he dies. Anyway.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
When you say they traded, the dad traded back to his son, did that have to go be done via the person that made the curse or put the curse on the dad?
That's an interesting question. I don't believe so. I think he was just kind of like, okay, I get in and it got switched. I'm not really sure what the details are. Does anybody have to know the details of that? Man, I'm not really sure, but my assumption is that it just kind of went back on its own once he realized, had that realization. Yeah, and there may be even a backstory behind that of, like, I mean, who knows, you know. Wherever there's a gap, somebody has come up with a story to explain that.
Before I flip it, how is this related to the Pandavas and
Puru? Oh, okay, so Puru, the good son, he becomes the great-great-grand ancestor of the Pandavas and the Kauravas. So again, right here. Yayati, so Yayati and the Yadus go over to here, right, into Mathura. These guys stay in Hastinapura, and then from Puru, the good son, comes all of this. Okay, so he becomes the ancestor. So you'll see in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, he'll call Arjuna O Puru, you know, or Pārava, right? You know, okay, more curses? It's just a whole series of curses. Okay, King Shantanu. Okay, so now I'm right here. Okay, so we had a few different generations pass, and now we have Shantanu, right? Just to kind of get ahead of myself a little bit, Shantanu has a child with Ganga, the goddess of the river, producing Bhishma, again, the cognate of Dyaus. He's their incarnation of Dyaus, one of the Vasus. Shantanu also has a child, two children, with Satyavati, Chittarangada and Vichitravirya, right? Okay. Satyavati, with this sage over here, had a son by the name of Vyasa, Krishna Dvapayana. Okay, I will tell all these stories, but I'm going to start with Shantanu. So now we're at this layer here. Okay, everybody sees where we're at. So when I say the name King Shantanu, you guys can go over to here and go, who are we talking about again? Okay. I hope this works. Okay, so there's a background to this story, as you may have expected. Up in the heavens, a great king gets invited to the court of Rama, right? And sitting there is the goddess Ganga, right? And a wind blows, a breeze, and her sari lifts up a little bit. All the other kings have the good sense to look away, except Mahabisha, because they had a little bit of attraction when he first came into the room. And he, of course, does a double take on that, right? Brahma is infuriated. He's like, we will not have that in my court. Go to Bhuloka. Bhuloka is our world, right? This is Bhumi, right? The earth. The Loka, the world of Bhu, right? This is a Om Bhuvasaha. So this is our earth. So he curses him to go down to Bhuloka. And Mahabisha is just like, oh man, I gotta go be a human. And he's all mad and kind of skulking away. And Ganga feels bad because she's partly responsible. And she's like, oh, so she follows him down there. On her way, she comes across these eight Vasus. All right? These eight Vasus are fallen gods in a sense, too. The wife of Dyaus, Yogasiddhi, she has a friend who's a mortal queen. And she loves her friend, but she just feels so bad for having to be a stupid mortal. And so she's like, she gets all the Vasus together, and she's like, hey, you guys, let's go visit Vashishta, one of these Vedic rishis. Let's go visit Vashishta. He can do cool things. Maybe he can help her out. And they go, and Vashishta has this wonderful cow, Nandini. What is it? Ishtaduk. Kama Ishtaduk, the cow that produces whatever you desire, right? This infinite cow. I'm not going to go into the story, but you may remember the conflict between Vishwamitra and Vashishta, right? Which I'm not going to tell that story. Vashishta has this wonderful cow, and they figure, well, this cow is going to be able to do the trick for us. So the wife of Dyaus, Yogasiddhi, says, hey, why don't you go steal that cow for me so we can help out my friend? And Dyaus, being a good husband, never says no. He says, okay, I'll go steal this cow. Let me get my Vasu homies together, and we're going to go steal this cow, do some cattle raiding, right? And, of course, Vashishta catches them, and he curses them, and what does he say? That's coming. He says, go to Bhuloka. So these guys get the same curse, right? And as you may imagine, they actually meet up down here, right? So Dyaus, you know, is like, no, please, don't do this to me. And he says, okay. You can be born somebody important. All right, I'm gonna let you be somebody important. However, and then what Dyaus is saying is he's like, I want to be the son of King Pratipa, right? He's this awesome king. If I gotta be born Bhuloka, at least let me be the son of Pratipa, right? And Vishisha's like, okay, fine. You can be somebody important. You can be born to this cool guy, but your life is gonna suck, and you're not allowed to have kids. right? Which is like the most awful thing, right? Apparently. So Dios is like, okay, fine. Okay, so Ganga is back here following Mahabisha back to Bhuloka. She runs into these Vasus who are now on their way to Bhuloka. And they're kind of like skulking around, and Ganga's like, what's wrong, you guys? And like, we gotta go vaginal birth, and it's gonna be a real mess, you know? It's gonna be awful, you know? It's like really this filthy process, you know? And you know, human beings, and Ganga's like, okay, I will spare you the indignity of having to be born to a mortal human, because that's just too much. I'll go incarnate, because she's thinking about Mahabisha anyway. She's like, I'll go incarnate. You guys can be born to me. And they're like, yeah, we're still going to have to be human. And that's like, she's like, okay, fine. I will kill you all when you're infants, right? And there's eight of them, right? And they're like, oh, that sounds like a pretty good deal. And then she kind of thinks about it. She's like, well, you know, killing all my kids, that's going to kind of suck. Maybe, though it might have sounded like a good idea to my mom at a certain point. maybe I just want to keep one of them. I'm going to keep one. I'll kill the rest of you guys, but I'm going to keep one, okay? And so you probably guess who that one is, right? So basically, Ganga makes this promise to these guys. Okay, so then Pratipa, the guy that Vasu is the awesome dude, is born to, his dad meets Ganga. There's a story about she comes up, sits on his left thigh, and says, hey, will you marry me? He's like, no, you sat on my left thigh. That's where my daughter should sit. Therefore, you are like a daughter for me. Therefore, you should marry my son. And then he has a son. The son is King Shantanu. King Shantanu is the incarnation of Mahabisha, right? So he comes down and is reborn through Pratipa. Am I getting ahead of myself? Nah, Mahabisha.
Yes.
That's right, okay. And then Ganga and Shantanu basically meet and hook up. You know, Shantanu is like, if you've seen the Mahabharata TV show, it's really great. Plastic jewelry is just awesome in that. He sees this beautiful woman walking out of the river Ganges, and he's just totally taken away by her, and he just falls at her feet and is like, I love you. That wasn't meant my wife. I love you. Except my wife was kind of like, ew. But she wasn't. She wasn't. She liked him. He maybe was more attractive than I. You can sit in the front row, I guess. So anyway, basically she says, okay, look, I'll marry you, but under one condition. You must never question anything that I do, ever. And he's just like being a good man. Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, no problem. I won't question anything. So they get married. She gets pregnant. She takes the baby to the river and drowns it. He's like, what is going on? Happens again. 7 times. The babies are all taken down the river and drowned. Shantanu is a disaster. He's a mess. He's losing it. He's like, he needs a son, because he's got to have an heir to the kingdom. Plus, if he wants to go to heaven, he's got to have a son. You know, it's very important to have a son. And here she keeps killing them all, and he's just losing it. And finally, on the last one, he can't take it. And his subjects are starting to like get really frustrated, too. They're like, what's wrong with our king? He's so lame. He keeps killing his own kids. So finally, he intervenes on the last one, and he says, what are you doing? You can't do this. And she says, I told you never to ask me that. So she takes the son, names him Devavrata, means like the vow of the god, Devavrata, which foreshadows some of his later behavior, and she disappears up in heaven for 16 years. Okay. 16 years later, Shantanu is like kind of bummed out. He's kind of a wreck of a dude. And, you know, he lost all his kids, lost his woman. And he's just kind of, you know, walking on the Ganges, reminiscing one day, and he notices that the Ganges is kind of like stopped up and there's no water flowing. And he looks up and he sees all these arrows, like kind of damming the Ganges, so the water's not flowing. He goes up there and he sees this kind of like precocious little kid who's just like, stopping the Ganges by shooting arrows. And he's like, who are you? And then Ganga comes down. It's like, this is your son. He's 16. He needs a man in his life. I don't know. You take him now. And Shantanu's like, okay. So Shantanu takes Devavrata and... So basically, Devavrata is the incarnation of Gyaus, the one whose wife stole the cow. Okay? Everybody following me? I know, this stuff starts going along, and so it gets even worse. I mean, everything interrelates to everything else, and it gets really messy. Okay, Vina. So we're not done with King Shantanu yet. We got this relationship. Shantanu has Devavrata. Devavrata changes his name to Bhishma. Okay, Bhishma. And I will say, Bhishma is my favorite character in the Mahabharata, in case you guys are wondering. So, Shantanu, later on, marries another woman named Satyavati. And they have two sons. Very inconsequential characters. They die really early. And this is where our lineage starts getting into problem, right? So a lot of this anxiety, again, the kind of more of the historical backdrop of this, is there's a lot of anxiety around lineage, right? What's the problem with monarchs? You know, you can have, monarchy is awesome. If, as long as you got the right dictator, things are great. But then what happens when his son takes over and he's a real jerk? Well, at least they have a son, you know? So what happens is there's these kind of power vacuums and there's these situations of ambiguity about who should be the heir to the throne. And that's where the tension that leads up to the war comes from. And it really starts right up in here with Shantanu and Satyavati and their kids because they died too early. Little jerks. King Shantanu meets this woman named Satyavati. She's the daughter of a fisherman, right? Satyavati has got quite an interest. This is my favorite story in the whole Mahabharata. Satyavati, I'm a little reluctant to tell with my mom in the room. It's X-rated. Satyavati, basically, there's a King Vasu, no relation to the Vasus who just were reborn. King Vasu's out on a hunting trip. What does that tell us? Trouble, right? Something bad's going to happen. And he's just cruising along, and he kind of like looks at his little pocket calendar, and he's like, wait a minute. My wife is ovulating. Oh, no. It says in the Shastras that if I don't have sex with my wife when she's ovulating, it's the same as killing my own son. You know? I got to get home. And he does math work. He's like, oh, no, I'm going to miss it. You know? Oh, no, I'm doing this horrible. What am I going to do? So he spills his seed into a leaf. Folds it up, UPS, hands it to an eagle, and he says, bring this to my wife. Express, emergency, refrigerated if you can. And so the eagle's cruising right along, but then the eagle decides, hey, I'm going to mate with this other eagle. And so they start mating, and in the process, drops the seed into the river. Yamuna, I believe it is. Okay. The seed falls into... Now, King Vasu is a very good king. And the more dharmic you are, the more infallible your semen is. Right? So, since he's such an awesome king, he's going to have very strong, potent semen. Right? It falls into the river, and a fish eats the semen. Okay? This may remind you of the story of Murugan, or Skanda, the son of Shiva. Right? Similar thing happens with Shiva spilling the seed on the floor. Ends up in the river, impregnates the reeds, and out comes Murugan, his other son, right? And he comes across the Kartikeyas, the goddesses of the Palladian, is that the right word? I always get mixed up with Pilates. Palladian constellation, right? And they're like, oh, he's so cute, let me breastfeed him! And he's like, ladies, please, I'll just sprout six heads. You can all breastfeed me. And so it grows all these heads. And so that's what happens with Shiva-san. That's what Shiva-san. So this story is a little bit similar, right? This infallible semen hits the river. Fish eats it. This fish is actually Adrika, which is a fallen apsara, which is a celestial maiden. Anyway, she eats it. She gets caught by a fisherman. Fisherman's like, you know, cooking his dinner, cuts open the stomach, and oh my goodness, there's two baby sons in there, right? What am I going to do? This is crazy. I can't handle this. I'm going to bring it to the king. So he goes to the king. He's like, king, I found this in the fish. It's kind of freaking me out. What do I do? And the king's like, I'll take the son. You can have the daughter, whatever. I'll take the son. And so he raises the son, and the son becomes the heir to the Matsya, another Mahajana Pada, which I neglected to put up here. So he becomes part of the heir to the Matsya, right? The daughter, on the other hand, becomes raised by the fisherman. And at first, she's known as... She has a couple different names. Let me see it there. I wrote them down right here. She's known for her terrible smell, her terrible fishy smell. She smells really bad, right? And nobody likes that. Also, she has very, very dark skin, which is something that's kind of looked down upon, right? Sort of, though even Krishna has blue skin, and that actually means dark. So in that case, he's actually looked up to. But she has dark skin, right? She's got this awful smell. But she's got a good heart, right? So she gets to work as the fairy person, right? You trawl these people across the river. And that's her job, right? And then along comes this sage, this rishi, Partha Sharda, right? And Partha Sharda is feeling a little feisty. Most of these sages are pretty celibate because they're retaining their semen for their own power, right? But this guy's feeling a little feisty. And he propositions Satyavati. She changed her name to Satyavati from her previous name that means something like stinky girl or something. I can't remember what it is. So he propositions her, and she's like, No, not gonna happen. Because, you know, these guys are nasty. They live in the forest. They don't shower. They don't cut their hair. They don't, you know, they're wearing rags. It's like, you know, a homeless dude in San Francisco. They don't look very good because they're aesthetics, you know? And she's like, no, I'm not doing it. And he's like, please, please, come on, dude. She's like, okay, fine. Three conditions. All right? Number one, you gotta get rid of my smell. Right? You gotta just get rid of it. You know, how am I gonna get a husband like this? And so he's like, okay, I'll make you smell like flowers. So now her name gets changed to Yojana Ganda, right? Because she smells so fragrant, you can smell it for Yojana. Yojana is a particular unit of distance, right? And then number two, no man is going to want me unless I'm a virgin. So you have to restore my virginity. And of course, what does Parashar say? Oh yeah, no problem, yeah. And I'm sure that line has worked somewhere. I'll restore your virginity afterwards. I can see what the problem is. And then the other one, she's like, I can't have people seeing me getting busy out here on this boat, on this river. And he's like, okay, I'll pull up some fog and nobody will see. And she's like, yeah, okay, sounds like a good deal. Okay. So she does it. And because of this powerful semen of this rishi, she instantly gives birth. She's like, there's a little dvipa, an island in the middle of the river, and she jumps out, gives birth. He jumps up, starts walking around, and he's like, hey, anytime you need me, you can call me. You're my mom. But for now, I'm going to be a rishi. I'm just going to live on this island. Right? And his name, because she's dark skinned, she names her son Krishna. This is not the Krishna you're thinking of. We have three Krishnas, by the way. Four Krishnas. Four Krishnas, three Ramas. Okay? Anyone want to try to name them? We have Krishna, Vasudeva Krishna, our God. We have Krishna, this guy. We have Krishna, Draupadi. And then we have Krishna, one of the ten names of Arjuna. Yes. Okay, so in a particular episode, a character has to name all ten names of Arjuna. And he does, so in one of the names he gives is Krishna. So those are our four Krishnas. And then our Ramas, just to be totally pedantic here and off topic, our Ramas, we have Rama Dasharatha, the son of Dasharatha, which is the god Rama that we know. We have Pardeshu Rama, right? Rama Jamadagni, right? That's the Rama with an axe. He's going to come up here in a second. And then the last one we have is Balaram. Okay. So anyway, that was a little trivia for you in case you're ever on Hindu Jeopardy. So Satyavati has this kid, Krishna Dvapayana, right? And he is instantly grown up, and his name is Krishna because he's dark skinned, and Dvapayana because he's born on a dvipa, on an island, okay? And he also becomes now known as Vyasa. Vedic Vyasa, probably one of the most revered figures, maybe the most revered figure in Sanskrit literature in terms of the commentator. You want somebody to read something that you wrote in ancient India, you don't put your name on it. You put Vyasa's name on it. Right? So we have this commentary by Vyasa, that comment, everything by Vyasa. And you do not argue with Vyasa. Right? Vedic Vyasa is also known for, reciting the Mahabharata to Ganesha. Right? Remember? He's the guy who's doing that. Right? And then he's also known for splitting the Vedas up into four. Right? By some reckonings, three. But he's the guy that's why he's called Vedic Vyasa, the guy who split up the Vedas, right? So that's the Vyasa that comes up all the way in, you know, in our Yoga Sutra study. He's the main layer of commentary, etc. He's this very important, cool guy, and really smart, too, and I like him. Satyavati is now a virgin again, woohoo, so she can find a husband. Shantanu comes rolling up into town. Remember who Shantanu is? Shantanu is the one who just had the baby with the river Ganga gods, right? So he comes rolling up into town, he meets this really hot, wonderfully smelling fairy lady, and he's like, hey, I like you. That smell is intoxicating. What do you say? And she's down. She's like, yeah, let's do it. Let's go talk to my dad. And dad is like, we got some negotiations. Some king coming from my dad. Remember, he's a fisherman. He's like, I'm going to work this. I'm going to milk this. So he's like, okay, you can marry my daughter, but I want your son with her to be the heir to your throne, the heir to the Hastinapura throne, right? This big lineage, right? That's my son. Shantan is distraught. Why is he distraught? He already has a son.
Vichitra Devavrata.
Okay? He can't possibly do that to his son. His son is the rightful heir. And so he becomes very despondent. You know, moping around in the palace. You know, nobody knows what's wrong with Shantanu. And finally, Devavrata, who's going to be Bhishma in a minute here, asks his father. His father won't tell him because his father doesn't want to pressure his son. So he asks the advisors, what's going on with Dad? Why is he moping around? And they tell him the story. Satyavati can't marry him because of this arrangement. And Bhishma says, no problem, I'll handle this. Good son. Okay? Good son goes to fishermen and says, look, let my father marry your daughter. And if you do, I will take a vow. Right? And this vow is that I will be celibate for life. I will not have any children. And I will renounce the throne. And I will not take the throne. And I will worship whoever is sitting in that throne. Which becomes a very key clause in this. And it leads to kind of the downfall. It's the reason why Bhishma has a really sad life. Remember, he was cursed to have a sad life. So, under these conditions. And Fisherman Dad is like, oh, that sounds good. Okay, we can do that. All right. The gods come down, and they start chanting, awesome, 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 you're awesome. And what is the Sanskrit name for awesome? Awesome. Bhishma. So they start calling him awesome from there on out, right? So Bhishma means awesome. So he's this awesome guy because he got this awesome vow. And because of that, he's giving this Svetramritu vow. This ability to control the time of his death. Right? So when he's laying on the bed of arrows, he doesn't die. He says, I'm going to wait till the moon is in the auspicious place in the sky before I die. And he lays there and suffers like a good kshatriya. And also so he can give the dissertation to Yudhishthira, who inherits the throne after the battle. Jumping ahead. Okay, so this is Bhishma's story. Okay, so now we have something good here. Shantanu can marry his love, the wonderfully smelling Satyavati. and then they can actually have kids. They have two kids. I can barely even say this guy's name because you never hear it, but Chittarangada, and the other one would be Chitravira. I can say this one a little bit more because Chittaranga died in some kind of battle early on, gone. Okay, no heir. Right, you notice there's no arrow. So you guys see the blue lines are the heirs, right? The red names are the women. The red lines are the marriage relationships. So these are all the people who are married to each other, right? And then I highlighted the people, well, Bhishma just gives me my favorite, and Pandavas and the Kauravas. These are going to be our heroes and our villains, okay? So this is all coming out of this. The Chitravirya is now coming to age. His brother, Bhishma, is kind of taking care of things for his little brother here. And he's like, hey, you know what? I'm going to go get you some wives. I heard these triplets. I don't know if they're actually triplets, but they're sisters. The three sisters are really hot. Amba, Ambika, and Ambalika. He's like, they're going to be perfect. I'm going to go kidnap them for you. All right? Because this is just how you roll back in those days. You know, you want a wife. There's so many kidnappers. That's how Arjuna marries Subhadra, right? And he kidnaps her, right? So I'm gonna go kidnap you these women. It's gonna be great. You know, you're gonna love these women. So Chittarangada dies. Yudhishthira, that's a crown on his head. So he's like the king. He's gonna be the heir, right? And Bhishma goes to steal these daughters, right? Now guess what? One of these girls, Amba, Angie had a dream about last night. Amba already has a man. And nobody knows it. Salva. Bhishma didn't know this, right? He takes the three, throws them in the back of the chariot. I hope he didn't tie them up. No, he didn't. Because this is kind of like custom, you know? It's not as horrible as it sounds to us, I guess. So he's driving off with these three wedges. And Amba's going, wait, no, you can't do this. And she's like, why not? And she says, I already have a man. And instantly Bhishma's like, you can't do that. Because she's, in a sense, she's already in somebody else, because Pati, husband, means like the one who protects. So in a sense, she's kind of under the protection of another man, so you can't just taker and giver to another man. This is hugely problematic. Bhishma's like, get out of the chariot. Go back, right? So she goes back to Salva.
Right.
And she says, dude, I almost got married to somebody else. And Salva is like, I can't marry you. You've been alone with this other man.
Wow.
How do I know? You were contaminated, in a sense. So then she goes to Bhishma, and she says, well, Bhishma, jerk, now you have to marry me. Right? Because you're the one who screwed this all up. Right? She can't marry Vichitravirya because of her relation with Salva. Salva won't marry her because she had contact with Bhishma, so it makes sense that Bhishma is the one that should marry her. Right? And Bhishma's like, they don't call me Bhishma for nothing. I'm awesome. I don't mess with women. I'm way too awesome for that, you know? I mean, I feel like he's sympathetic. He's not, you know, he's not a jerk by any means, you know? He's sympathetic to this. And he's so sympathetic that he actually, in a sense, dies because he honors what he did to her, which foreshadows something that's happening. So what happens is Amba becomes very, very angry. So what do you do when you're angry? This is a tip for all you guys. You go practice austerities. What was it?
You curse somebody.
Curse. But you need power. If you want to curse somebody, you've got to get power. Where do you get power? Practice an austerity. So she rolls up into the forest, does all these austerities, and I believe it's Shiva presents her with this garland. And she's like Shiva comes down, you know, it's like granting her this boon. You know, what do you want? Your austerities are so rad. What can I do for you? And she's like, I want to kill Bhishma. And Shiva's like, it's kind of awesome. I'll give you this garland, and whoever's wearing this garland will kill Bhishma. Okay? And so she goes on to, this is not on here, so I'm kind of flying in the dark here, but she goes to Drupada's palace, who's going to come up here in a moment in the context of Drona. She goes to Drupada's palace, and she's like, you know, help me kill Bhishma. And Drupada's like, screw you, I'm not messing with Bhishma, he's awesome. And so she takes this garland, and she hangs it on his gate, and kind of storms off, and she goes to Parthashurama, who is one of our Ramas, Rama Jama Dagni, same name, and she says, what can I do? And he kind of agrees to fight Bhishma. And even though he's Bhishma's teacher, martial arts teacher, long story, they fight. It's a 27-day standoff. Nobody wins. They're actually very cordial and very polite with each other. I mean, it's not really. And then it's a draw, right? So, you know, Bhishma becomes now the awesome guy who stood up to Ramajagnadagni, who's a fierce warrior, because he killed all of the Kshatriyas right down to the embryos in their wombs 21 times over. But that's a long. That's another Holocaust. That was one I should have mentioned before. Back up to Sarpamega, the sacrifice to kill all the snakes. They're doing this at a specific location, and this is the location where Ramajamadagni, this dude who I just mentioned, who is Bhishma's teacher, who they just fought, Ramajamadagni's father was killed by a Kshatriya, by a warrior, somebody of the Kshatriya class. And Ramajamadagni, I'm not going to go into the whole story, he gets really, really pissed, and he's like, he's a Brahma, but then he becomes a Bhrigu Brahmas. There's this kind of like lineage of Brahmas, of Brahmins, who are kind of militant, you know, they fight. And Ramajamadagni becomes one of these Bhargava Brahmins, and he basically just gets all his powers, and he kills all of the Kshatriyas on the planet. 21 times over. So they're reborn, he kills them again. They're reborn, he kills them again. They're reborn, they kill them again. And the literature says, right down to the embryos in their wombs. I mean, it's really... So again, this is the second major holocaust. So the first major holocaust is the Sarpameda to kill all of the snakes. The second one is this Ramajamadagni character going crazy, killing all of these people because of what happened to his father. And then he does an offering, a ritual offering to the gods. And instead of using water, he uses their blood. And at that very spot where he does that, that very spot, that's where the Sarpameda is happening. Right? So three holocausts of the Mahabharata come together at that one point where Vaishampayana and Janamejaya are speaking. You know, where he says, you know, he's trying to kill all the snakes, and he says, hey, tell me about my lineage. He tells him about the lineage. On the spot where Parashurama did the offering with the blood of the Kshatriyas, he's doing the holocaust to kill all the snakes,
And he tells him the story of the Kruge Schechter War that we're getting to, which is the third major Holocaust. So they all come together in this one point in time for this Serpent Maida. Anyway, that kind of backed up, and I know you're all confused and lost now. So let me get back to Bhishma and the Chitravirya. Okay, so what happens with Amba, remember Amba is the pissed off lady who doesn't get to marry anyone, wants to kill Bhishma. So she does all these penances, she throws the thing up on Drupada's gate, storms off, and she burns herself alive, which is a very common thing in the Mahabharata. A lot of women are doing that all the time. Immolation, you know, this is kind of, it's called, or Anglicization of that is Sauti, right, or S-U-T-E-E, it comes from the word Sati, which means virtuous woman. It's kind of really not a good term for it, but these women are always burning themselves alive. It's a common thing, it's a practice that actually happens in India, less and less these days. So she burns herself alive so she can be reborn, so that she can kill that Bhishma guy, because she's just frustrated. She becomes reborn, and guess what? Damn it, she's a girl again. She kind of, right? What am I going to do? I can't kill him if I'm a girl. So she does this whole thing out in the forest where she meets up with this yaksha. Remember, this is hinting to her in indigenous religions. She does this where she trades her gender with the yaksha, and she becomes male, Shikhandim, right? And that Shikhandim, that change of gender, now is a man. So she's a woman who burned herself, got reborn as a girl, traded her gender with the yaksha, so now she's the dude who's out to kill Bhishma, Shikhandim, right? And she's successful. He's now, right? So our PC pronoun will be a he, okay? So he's successful. But if you do watch the Mahabharata TV show, he's great, because he's like really flamboyant guy, like driving his chariot. I mean, they just really do. It's so campy. It's hilarious. But guess what happens? So that's Amba, okay? She becomes Shikhandi. She's going to kill Bhishma. So this Vichitravirya marries the other two girls, Ambika and Ambalika, right? So he marries these two other girls. But guess what? He dies of tuberculosis before he's able to produce an heir. So without an heir, again, we have a huge problem. Who is going to take the throne, right? We have these two wives who are surviving, right? And the custom would be to bring in the brother of the... I'm really not going to make a comment about that. I'm going to refrain. I'm going to hold back on that one. So the custom would be to bring in the brother. But who's the brother? Awesome dude. No, I don't mess with women. So basically, who else do we got up here? Wait a minute. Who's Vichitra's Vera's mom? Satyavati. Does Satyavati have anybody back there that we don't know about? Look, she does. Remember that dude that she gave birth to on that island all those years ago that she never told anybody about, got her virginity restored? He's still hanging around somewhere. And if he could have children with these two wives of the guy who's the dead heir to the throne, am I talking too fast now? Then they will have a legitimate heir. Two of them. So, remember when Vyasa was like, hey mom, thanks for giving birth to me. You can always call on me for anything. Anything you ever need. Anything at all. So Satyavati's like, dude, Shantanu, I got something to tell you. Yeah, I'm a virgin, but I was a virgin, but before I was a virgin, I had a kid. And his name's Gata, he's this great guy, and I think we're going to have to solve our lineage problems by bringing him up and on scene to have babies with Ambalika and Ambika, right? Nobody knows what else to do. It seems like the only solution. Vyasa's like, okay, if I have to do my service, I will. So, I think we switched it over here. So Vyasa rolls up in on the scene with these beautiful princesses. Remember, they're like all, you know, flowered up and everything. And Vyasa, what's he been doing? He's been living on an island, you know, not brushing his teeth, not brushing his hair, not renouncing the physical body, you know, just a dirty old nasty guy. And he comes walking up in here, he's like, hey, ladies. And they're like, no. But they have to do their, what did they say, to God and country or whatever? They have to do their duty, okay? So they do so. Vyasa gets called on, and first he goes to Ambika. And he says, Ambika, we have to do this, right? And Ambika's like, okay. And she closes her eyes the whole time. And he's like, how dare you? He gets insulted. He says, because you did that, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to curse you. That's what sages like to do. We call them irascible moonies. He says, I'm going to curse you. your son, our son, will be blind because you closed your eyes. All right? And unfortunately, she didn't really beg very well. So that just kind of goes to stand. Then he goes to Ambalika. He's like, Ambalika. And she just like freezes and turns white and is mortified. And he's like, oh, so I guess I'm not good enough for you. All right, because you turn pale, your son is going to be Pandu. What does Pandu mean? White dude. Little white guy. So he's a little pale guy, right? Kind of emaciated looking guy, I guess, right? So now we got this thing where Ambika and Ambalika, they've had two sons. They've got Pandu, white guy. You got Dhritarashtra, which is the blind guy, right? Dhritarashtra is older, but he's blind. So we can't give him the kingdom. We discriminate against people who are differently abled. Right? Okay, they didn't have ACLU back then. Alright? Pandu gets the throne until one day when he goes hunting.
Excuse me.
Vidura. Very important. So Vyasa's having so much fun with these two ladies that he just like calls in one of the servants and he's like, hey, let's do it. And the servant's cool. She's down with it. You know, apparently it's not the first Rishi she's been with. And she's like, hey, I love these Rishi guys. So they get down, they get busy, and they have a baby. And this baby, he's like, because you were so good, your baby is going to be possessed of high intelligence. And Vidura becomes one of the kind of, he can't be in line for, like, you know, Pandu and Dhritarashtra, they're in line for the throne because their parents were technically royalty. But because Vidura is the son of a servant, he can't be. But he's still revered, especially because he's this really smart guy because of Vyasa's boon. He becomes revered, and he becomes one of the major voices of reason in the court. You know, when everybody's rushing to war, he's one of the guys who's like really representing the Dharma. So that's Vidura. Thank you. Okay. So Vidura is up in here somewhere. I didn't put him on this board because he's not really playing in the whole lineage crisis. So back to lineage crisis. Blind king. Can't be king. You're blind. A Pandu, white guy. He's going to take the throne. And then he goes hunting. He's out hunting and he sees these deers mating. And he's just like, whatever. Kills them, right? It turns out that this wasn't really a deer. You got to be careful who you shoot in the forest. These were not really deers. They turned into a rishi. So it was a forest sage. And he had, I suppose a fetish would be the only way you could say it, but he was, him and his partner liked to turn into animals before they, hey, we're not judging that. That's okay, right? As long as they're both animals, I think it's okay. But anyway, so he comes to, and he's like, that was a dharmic. That was wrong that you did that. You were not supposed to shoot an animal in the moment of pleasure, right? Everybody knows what a shloka is?
No.
A shloka? A shloka is a verse, a metric verse of 8 syllables, right? And the term shloka comes from the word shoka, which means grief, right? This goes to Ramayana, okay, the other major epic. Tangent. So Ramayana, the sage Narada goes to Valmiki. Valmiki goes out to the forest. He's having, Valmiki says to Narada, tell me about the perfect man. And Narada says, here, let me tell you about Rama. And Valmiki's so high from hearing this story about Rama, he's just blissing through the forest. He looks over and he sees these beautiful Baka cranes and they're mating and he's like, life is beautiful. And this little Nishada tribal guy comes up and bam, kills him. And Valmiki is overcome with rage and what does he do? I curse you. He says, but then as he does it, all of a sudden he does it in a poem. Just like spontaneous, this poetry comes out to him in this shloka meter, this 8-meter. And he curses the guy, and then he's like, oh, wait a minute, that was kind of weird. What was that? So he goes back to his ashram, and he's tripping out on this meter, and Brahma comes down, and Brahma says, you know what? I did that to you so that you could compose the story of Rama that you just heard from Narada in that meter so that you can write the Ramayana, essentially. And that's anyway, this is just another story about killing two animals while they're mating. That's the only reason I'm telling you that, and I'm sorry. Push that away. Okay. Back to Pandu's unfortunate hunting trip. Kills the Rishi, curses him, and he says, since you killed me in my moment of sexual ecstasy, you can never have sex again. If you do, you're going to die. all right? And Pondu is like, no! Why? Because Pondu's got this really hot wife that he cannot keep his hands off of. Back up. Pandu's married to two wives. One is Kunti, the other is Madhu. And it's really sad, because the senior wives are always like, oh yeah, she was really awesome until I got my young wife, right? And this is the story with Dasharatha and Kaikeyi, right, from Ramayana. Anyway, I gotta quit talking about the Ramayana. One epic at a time. So, he marries Kunti. Kunti is the daughter of a Yadava, ruler of Mathura, which makes her a relative of the Supreme Lord, right? So she's a relative of Krishna. So, she's the daughter of a ruler named Surasena, who's the father of Vasudeva, which makes Surasena the grandfather of Krishna. Anyway, so whatever, she's related to Krishna, okay? So Kunti has this interesting story, okay? This is the first wife. Kunti, when she's young, she's chilling at her dad's house, right? King, what was his name again? King Surasena.
It's actually Kunti Poja, she was adopted.
Kunti
Bhoja, she was adopted.
Okay. Oh, that's Kunti Bhoja, the adopted father. Okay, gotcha, thank you. But she's kicking out that place, and a rishi comes up. And this guy is a mean rishi. Dwardavasa. He's like this kind of really curmudgeon-y sort of mean guy, and he's cursed all kinds of people. I actually have a whole list of people he's cursed. But since I'm not doing this with notes, apparently, I'm not going to tell you all the people he's cursed. So Dwardavasa comes, and he's like, where's Kunti Bhoja? Where's your father? Why is he not here? I'm a rishi. He's not meeting me, right? That's a bad thing. You're not supposed to let a Brahmin wait, right? Because if you remember Katha Upanishad, right, and Yama, right? Nachiketa has to wait for the god Yama. And the god Yama has to propitiate Nachiketa for making him wait, gives him the boons, etc. That's Katha Upanishad. Different story. So, why are you making me wait? You know, serve me. Where's my dad? And Kunti knows exactly how to handle this guy. She starts bringing him food. She's massaging his feet. She's doing all this nice stuff for him. And Dwardavasa, who's a pretty mean old dude who's known for cursing people, he's like, eh, you're actually pretty cool. I'm going to give you this boon. This boon is that you can repeat this mantra, and any god you want will come down and impregnate you. And Kunti... What's that? Oh, did you mention the pregnant part? Okay.
No.
So he's like, you can have any god you want, right? And Kunti is like, okay. So she's kind of like a young girl. She's like, oh, let me just try this out and see if it works. So she does this and she thinks of Surya, the sun god, right? This is one of the more distasteful scenes in Mahabharata. Surya comes down and Surya's like, here I am. And Kunti's like, no, I changed my mind. I got to be a virgin. No, no, we can't do this, you know? And Surya basically... has his way with her. He forces her himself upon her, right? She becomes pregnant. She has a baby. He's born with this kavacha, this armor, and these big gold earrings, and she names him Karna. Karna means ear because of his earrings. Okay, I'm going to name you Karna, all right? And so she has this son, Karna, and she's like, nobody's going to want to marry me. Same problem that, what's her face back here had, you know, Satyavati had. Nobody's going to want to marry me. You know, if I've already had a baby. I'm just going to put this baby in a basket and push him down the river. Right? Forget this ever happened. Karna goes cruising on down the river, gets picked up by a Suta family. A Suta family is like the charioteers, right? They're low caste, and they find Karna and they raise him as their own. Karna will come back to haunt us. Okay? But for now, he's gone. Kunti, in the meantime, is like, oh, no, that's cool, I'm a virgin. She marries Pandu. Remember the guy who just went hunting and killed the two deers? Right? Pandu is now...
She married him long before he...
Yes, long before that. So, yes, before that. But they haven't had any children together, right? Pandu marries Madhuri. Do I have something about Madhuri? Beautiful and irresistible. Like Kaikeyi, okay? Right? Pandu's cursed. Pandu... So, basically, what ends up happening is Pandu now can't have any heirs because he can't have sex anymore because he shot these two deers and got cursed. Right? So, Pandu is, like, out of the lineage business. Right? And Dhritarashtra is not technically the king. So it was all dependent on him having kids, and now he can't do it. Alright? So Kunti's like, okay, I have a solution for this. Back in the day, Dwardavasa gave me this mantra, right? I can just call down some different gods, and we will have kids. Okay? And there'll be sons, and there'll be the heir to the throne. And Pandu's like, okay, I mean, we got to do this, right? So she calls down one by one. So this is Karna, the guy she pushed in the basket down the river. He is not considered one of the Pandavas because he's kind of the estranged son, right? Kunti first calls down the god Dharma. See, I put the names of the gods here underneath. Surya, this is the son of the sun god. So she calls down Dharma, has a baby. Son is Yudhishthira, the son of Dharma. He becomes Dharma Raja, the Dharmic king. He's known for his righteousness, and he's the firstborn. So he's the one who's supposed to be in line for the kingdom. She calls down Vayu, god of the wind, has the big Rakodara, the wolf-bellied Bhima, right? The guy who never stops eating, big, dumb, with a good heart, right? That's kind of how he's presented. But also just a total badass. Like, I mean, at one point he like throws everybody up on his shoulders and just starts running. You know, like all his brothers, his mom throws them all up on his shoulders and he just starts running. He's just a big, strong dude. Ardhajuna, Indra, right? Calls down Indra, god of the storm, maybe. You can think of, and then Madhuri's getting a little jealous. She's like, you know, she's the young hot wife. She's like, hey, wait a minute, I want to have kids too. And Kunti's like, okay, you can borrow my mantra. And so he borrows mantra. It's called them the Ashvins. The Ashvins are some Vedic deities. These are all Vedic deities. Okay, you see, these are all Vedic deities. All right, so they're in this position where they're just kind of starting to go down a little bit. Right, they're not the main god because they all become subordinated to Krishna in this story. Right. So this is again back to that post-Vedic theme of the Vedic gods going down on the escalator while the post-Vedic gods, i.e. Krishna, Vishnu, are getting elevated up. So she has these two sons that are twins, Nakula and Sahadeva. Okay. It turns out Pandu doesn't have very much willpower. Pandu goes to Madhuri and he says, Madhuri, let's do it. I don't care if it kills me. You look so good. And Madhuri is like, no, we are not doing it. And he basically forces himself upon her, right? So again, you have like a, I don't know if conjugal rape is too strong of a word, but he definitely forces himself upon her. And guess what? Oh man, I didn't put a dead face. Okay. Well, Pandu's dead. Pandu's dead. Lack of self-control. Okay. So that's what happens if you don't have proper control. Sensei Drona.
Wait, what about the birth of the other ones?
What about the birth of the other ones? Okay, so Gandhari. Did I not have Gandhari up there? Gandhari must have been up there. Oh, yeah. Dhritarashtra and Gandhari. Okay, so remember we have two brothers here from the girls who had the kids with the nasty sage Vyasa. One of them's blind, the other one's pale. Pale dude just died because he forced himself on his wife because of the curse of the hunting everybody's following. Okay, now let's talk about blind dude. Okay, Dhritarashtra, right? He marries this woman, Gandhari, who's from Gandhara, right? Afghanistan, right? He's Afghani. This is a cultural center known for a university and a lot of learning, a lot of Buddhist schools up in here. So Gandhari is basically means the girl from Gandhara, right? She gets set up to marry Dhritarashtra by Bhishma. Bhishma basically goes to get her, right? She has a brother named Shakuni who's not too happy about this. He doesn't want his sister marrying some blind guy, right? So he gets a little bit mad, and Shakuni is going to come back to haunt us. As a matter of fact, I think if there's one really bad villain in this whole thing who's kind of unequivocally bad, that would be Shakuni. Like, all these other villains, these guys, I mean, I don't know, they're jerks. They certainly are jerks. But there's times when they act righteously, and they kind of have a good case in a way, you know? Like, it's not just completely obvious that they're just being jerks, you know? This guy, Duryodhana, the main villain, he's being pushed by Shikhandi, Gandhari's brother. Shakuni, Gandhari's brother, who's upset that Bhishma his sister up with a blind lady. A blind guy. Okay. Okay, so when she hears that her husband-to-be is blind, she takes a vow. She's pativratam, one whose vow is her husband. That's what the job of women is pativratam. That's their job in the literature, to be vowed devotion to their husband. When she hears that he's blind, she decides she cannot have an ability that her husband doesn't have. So she will wear a blindfold for the rest of her life. Alright? Now, what do you get from that kind of asceticism? You get power. A lot of power. She wears this blindfold her whole life, and she builds up all of this power and all of this energy and all this strength for being this righteous woman, strong enough to even kill the Supreme Lord himself, Krishna. But that's another story. She has a 2-year pregnancy with Dhritarashtra. Very painful, right? And then all of a sudden she gives birth to this like ball of flesh. And everybody's like, what is that? And Vyasa's like, I know what to do. Remember Vyasa, this guy? Yeah, the guy who's getting busy with the ladies. He's like, I know what to do. Cut it up into 101 pieces and plant it in vats of ghee. Right? He uses like magical substance, right? And they're like, okay, since you're Vyasa, we're going to listen to you. Also, Gandhari is known for being a devotee of Shiva. And then she curses Krishna. So he cuts it up into these 101 pieces. And of that are born the 100 sons of Dhritarashtra and Gandhari. They have 98 others, of which the most important ones are Duryodhana. He's their main bad guy. A lot of this story is Duryodhana and Yudhishthira fighting for the throne. Who's going to be the king? The son of the blind guy who can't be a king, he's the older brother. He should be the king. But just because he's blind, his son should not be the king. Or Pandu, who technically didn't have any sons. He technically didn't have any sons. Right? This is kind of where I sort of sympathize with these guys' argument, because technically this is the older brother, and he shouldn't be discriminated against just because he's blind. And also, this guy's actually his son, whereas these guys are like actually sons of gods, which may actually be better, I don't know. But, so, Duryodhana, Dusala is the one soul sister, not like soul sister, but the only sister, and then Dushasana, she's black, she's from disco, Dusala is the only sister, Dushasana is kind of the one of the henchmen for Duryodhana, and then there's these 98 other guys who just kind of like stumble around, right? Dushasana becomes very, very important in the mythological, figurative sexual assault on Draupadi later. Okay, anything else I'm forgetting, Richard? I'm glad you're here. Yeah. Alright, Andy? Okay, so we have this crisis. So these guys, Duryodhana is younger than Yudhishthira, they're fighting for the kingdom, right? But even though Duryodhana's main rivalry is with Bhima, because they're both these like really big, strong, badass guys, and they both kind of like have the same weapon, this mace that they struggle with, and they're like the main enemies, like Bhima and Duryodhana. And Bhima's got a bad temper, too. Whereas Yudhishthira is very, very forgiving and always trying to be dharmic and always trying to do the right thing. Bhima's kind of a hothead. Bhima's always ready to kick some ass. And he doesn't like bad guys. And he wants to kick his ass. So there's this kind of like tension between these guys. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, so now we have all of these cousins. We have 101 of these guys. We have 5 of these guys. And they need a teacher. They need a sensei. Now, keep in mind, obviously, this is a Japanese name, right? But sensei Drona. Right? So Drona means vessel. His dad was an archer who was a really good archer who practiced a lot of tapas. And when you practice tapas austerities, so you practice a lot of austerities, when you get too much austerities and you start getting powerful, literally Indra's throne in heaven starts to warm up. And Indra's sitting there in his court and suddenly he feels his throne getting kind of warm. And he starts going, you know, this is not right. Somebody down there is getting too much power. I don't want them to usurp me. So what he does is he says the best way to get somebody to lose their power is send a woman down. Right? So they have all these celestial maidens, right? These apsaras, these dancing girls in the court, right? And he picks one out and he says, you go down. You take care of this guy. And so, you know, this guy's out here doing his archery. He's being a badass. He's all tough. He looks over. He sees this hot apsara bathing in the water and, damn it, spills his seed in a pot. And since he's got such strong, infallible seed, guess what? Bam! Oh, pops a little baby name, Drona! Okay? So that's a wonderfully eccentric story of Drona's birth. You have these kind of guys all the time. It's not that he's not the only guy to be born in a pot in the Sanskrit literature. I love this stuff.
the word is test tube.
Test tube. Oh, yeah, no, yeah. Test tube. Test tube. Wait, it does literally mean like vessel, right? Vessel. So I suppose we could go with test tube. Okay. So Drona is raised up here in the, I guess what we could call the Vedic heartland of Kuru Panchala, right? And his best friend forever is Drupada. We've heard of Drupada already. Remember the wreath that got hung on the dude's gate from the lady who wants to kill Bhishma, who burned herself alive and then becomes born a woman and trades her gender with the yaksha so she can be a man so she can kill Bhishma? Remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. what was I saying? The person whose gate she hung that wreath on was Drupada. That's all I'm trying to say. Okay, so Drupada and Drona are these kind of like best friends, right? And Drona's kind of like this poor guy, and Drupada's kind of like this like king guy who's going to take care of the kingdom, right? Drona marries Kripi, who's a sister of Kripa. Kripa becomes the maybe the Purohita, the kind of like the chief priest of Hastinapura, right? And Kripa becomes the teacher of pride. Shit, if you remember all this stuff going on down here, the guy who bit the food that had the snake in and got poisoned because he threw the snake around the rishi's neck and got killed, and then his son is doing the snake sacrifice to kill all the snakes. Remember that? Okay. That's his teacher. His teacher is Kripa, who's the brother of the sister who just married Drona. Okay? No, not okay. Not important. his guru is Parthasru Rama. Remember the guy? Remember the guy who got pissed off because the Kshatriya killed his dad and he killed all the 21 people over and over again? And
yeah.
It's right down there. Okay, that's his sensei. That's Drona's sensei. So Sensei Drona's sensei is this total badass guy who just got done killing all the Kshatriyas all these times, right? Okay, that's just to say that Drona's kind of a badass because he had this really badass guru. Okay, so it turns out that things are not going so good for Drupada and Kripi and his son Drona, what did I say? Drona. Okay, Drona. Things are not going so well for Drona and Kripi, his wife, and they have a new son, Ashvatthama, right? Who becomes a very, very important figure. Remember this guy, Parikshit? Remember how his name is destroyed? And do you remember how... Wait, was that... I might be getting mixed up. Never mind. Anyway, so they have a son. What's that?
It wasn't.
It was the same. Okay, so remember how somebody deployed a weapon to the pregnant Uttara that killed the embryo that was then saved and brought back to life and becomes Parikshit? That guy was Drona's son, Ashvatthama. Okay, so this stuff starts... They start colliding. And it starts getting kind of confusing because you understand this story, 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 but do you understand how they all relate to each other? That's where you start getting screwed up because it becomes one really big story, okay? It's a man, yeah, it's a soap opera. I mean, come on, these people don't have TV either, so they're a soap opera, right? So Drona is poor with his sister, with his wife Kripi and their son Ashvatthama, and he remembers his BFF from when he was a kid, Drupada, who's now like this king. And he's like, hey, King Drupada, the guy with the garland hanging on his gate, hey, King Drupada, help me out, man, remember? We're best friends! And Drupada looks at him and says, are you crazy? I'm a king. You don't come to me as an equal asking for anything. No. He says, if you come to me as a beggar because I'm a king and I'm merciful, I will give you whatever you want. But you don't come walking up in here acting like you're my equal. Right? Drona is pissed. So what does Drona want? Revenge. Right? So he gets refused for being... Okay, so now look here. We got this little theme here. He gets refused for being a caste inferior to Drupada. Right? So you see these refusals here? All of these happen for the reason of caste, right? Somebody is of the wrong birth, so they're not eligible. So first one is Drupada refuses Drona help because he's not his equal. Drona gets mad. He trains with Parthasru Rama, the dude who's killing all the Kshatriyas 21 times, and he gets all these awesome powers, and he becomes this really rad martial arts teacher, you know? And basically... somehow or another he starts heading to Hastinapura to looking for a job essentially, right? And he finds the Pandavas and the Kaurava kids playing, right? And one of them drops a ball in a well. And I think they asked Drona for help. Hey, can you get a ball out of the well? And he says, what do I get for me? And one of them says, well, can't remember which one, says, hey, you know, we'll get you a job, or something like that. He's like, job? Yeah, I need a job. So what he does is he uses, like, this kind of magical, first he takes his ring off his finger, and he throws it in the bottom of the well. Then he takes all of these grass blades and throws them so that they stick to each other, and they stick to the ball, and then he uses it to fish the ball out, and then he throws more down and sticks the ring in the middle and pulls it up, and these kids are like, dude, kung fu! And they kind of freak out. They're like, this guy's awesome. Let's get him a job. We want him to be our sensei. So Kirpa, his sister's brother, offers him a job, and Dhritarashtra helps him. Right? His wife's brother helps him get a job. The Pandavas and the Kauravas are both like, dude, this guy's rad. Let's hire him. We want him to be our teacher. And Dhritarashtra helped, and they basically started the Gurukula, the school of Drona, as it were. So things are going along well. The kids are learning. Everybody's doing great stuff. Drona starts to really love Arjuna. Arjuna's the darling of Drona. He starts to even like Arjuna more than he likes his own son, Ashwatthama. Right? This laser pointer is so cool. This is the first time I've ever used one of these. I kind of like having one of these. Anyway, he starts to like Arjuna even more than he likes his own son. Arjuna is a very, very promising young archer, right? And Drona promises and he says, you know what? You're going to be the best archer in the world, right? And so one day the Pandavas are out hunting. Bad stuff will happen. And it's nighttime, right? And they hear this dog howling. And they can't sleep. And they're like, ah, who's doing that, right? And all of a sudden, they hear all these arrows. And they're like, what the heck was that? They go and look at the dog. No animals were hurt in the making of this episode. The dog's mouth is kind of like stitched shut by these arrows. And it's pitch black, right? Because it's a new moon. And they're like, who did it? And they came from a far distance. They're like, those arrows came from a far way. Who did that? How did they do it? What is going on? And Arjuna's like, I was the best archer, right? And out comes this little Nishada dude, Ekalavya, right? They follow the arrows. You know, Drona actually looks down at the direction, the trajectory. This is kind of like forensics or something. That the arrows came in and kind of extrapolates where they must have came from. They go back there and they find this little Nishada kid, right? These Nishadas are these kind of tribal caste people, right? These kind of pre-Sanskrit, pre-Vedicization? I invented a word. Sanskritization is an often common term that's used, but it doesn't really fully describe the process. The process is more like adopting Vedic culture. But these are the indigenous people, these Nishadas, right? And these guys get treated really bad in the Mahabharata, right? You're going to see the treatment of Nishada here, right? Okay, stark contrast. I'm trying to quit mentioning the Ramayana, but stark contrast to Ramayana, where King Dasharatha actually has a good friend named Guha, who's a Nishada. So Ramayana is a lot nicer to these Nishada tribal indigenous people than the Mahabharata is. The Mahabharata treats them pretty badly, as evidenced by Ekalavya, and then our House of Lack episode that's coming up. So Ekalavya, they go and they find Ekalavya, previous to this, Ekalavya had approached Drona, and said, Drona, can I be your student? You're the best teacher in the world. Please let me be your student. And Drona says, okay, cool. What are you, Nishada? Oh, sorry. No openings for Nishadas. You know, get out of here.
He's not a caste thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because he's a tribal. He's not part of the system. He's not part of the society. You know, he's non-Aryan. You know, the Aryas are the noble people. You're either one or you're not. And if you're not, you're not. And he wasn't. So look, you see how Drona, I'm pointing out the irony here with these underlined, Drona's mad because he got refused by Drupada for being of a wrong birth. And now Drona refuses Ekalavya for being the wrong birth. Won't teach him. There's this kind of excuse that it's the rules of the Gurukula, and that he's like, it's not my rules, or I didn't make the rules, right? But whatever, he refuses them. Ekalavya is so impressed by Drona that he's like, whatever, I won't stay at your school, but Drona, you're so awesome. I love you, man. You're still going to be my guru. So he goes out in the forest and he trains, and he makes a statue of Drona, and he worships the statue every day. And that's where he gets his mojo to train and be the most rad archer who can shoot and blindfold or close the mouth of a dog in a new moon, pitch black, by sound. Right? Drona determines, oh, he did this by sound. And Arjuna's like, what? I don't know that trick. I thought I was supposed to be the best. And Drona's a little embarrassed because Drona did give his word to Arjuna You know, Drona's like, oh, dude, I just broke my word. There's somebody better than Arju. And oh, no, this is bad. So basically, they go find Ekalavi, and they're like, who's your teacher? And he falls down at Drona's feet, and he's like, Drona's my teacher. Now Arjuna's like, I thought I was your bestie. And he kind of gets tiffy. And Drona's like, it's cool. He says, if I'm your teacher, I want Dakshina.
Did I not write that word?
Yeah, you did.
Where? Where's that?
Guru Dakshina, right? So it's tradition that when you have a teacher, usually when you're done with your studies, you give your teacher a gift. Right? And and whatever they ask, you give them, right? Panchajanya, this is how Krishna gets his conch shell, right? Panchajanya. Panchajanya, heard of Shikesham Deva Datta Dhananjaya, right? So anyway, Ekalavya says, or Drona says, I want my dakshina. Ekalavya says, what is it? He says, your right thumb. Pulls out a knife, cuts off his thumb. Here you go, teacher. And teacher's like, thank you very much. Good luck with your archery. Can't draw the bow anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? Doesn't pay his off to Ekalavya. Ekalavya is he's a very important figure for the Dalit movement, the kind of underclass. You see posters on Indian campuses praising Ekalavya, you know, this kind of like caste sort of uprising, denouncing the treatment of Ekalavya, and they kind of take him as this like this paragon of injustice towards the undercaste, right? And he becomes this kind of really important figure for that whole movement. So anyway, Ekalavya just does it, man. He doesn't even question. He does, you know, Guru wants to, he's got it. Doesn't even, no remorse or anything, you know. Then he starts doing it with his left hand, right? Mm-hmm. And he's never quite as good, but he still can kick some ass, which he does. Return of Karna. Karna also approaches Drona. Remember Karna? Okay, then we got, hey, I'm a little girl. I got this new mantra. Let me see if it works. I'm going to have a son. Oh, no, I don't want a son. I'm going to send him down the river. Remember that guy, Karna? Worn with the earrings and everything.
Yeah.
He's down the river. He's being raised by these charioteer people, these Sutta low caste. He goes up to Drona and says, Drona, man, you're awesome. Can I be your student? Drona's like, oh, and what caste are you? He's like, oh, my parents are Suttas. And he's like, I didn't make the rules, man. Kind of sends away Karna, right? And Karna gets pissed about this, you know. Karna's kind of depicted as somewhere deep down inside he knows that he's a kshatriya. Check this out. Who would you think is the rightful heir to this throne? Not Yudhishthira. Karna is the older brother, right? He was born way before any of these guys, right? This is this really interesting character, and the literature is very sympathetic towards him. And he's pissed because he keeps getting discriminated against because he's a Sutta, and he thinks he's a Sutta. And when he finally finds out that he's not a Sutta and that Kunti's his mother, there is hell to pay, right? And he wants to go after Arjuna, right? Anyway, and then he actually ends up getting killed, Karnabara. Anyway, so Karna gets refused. So he's like, okay, I'm going to go learn to kick some ass. Who am I going to go to? That badass dude who can kill all the Kshatriyas 21 times over, part of the Shu Rama, Rama Jama Jagni, right down to the embryos. Jamadagni, hook me up. Teach me some stuff, right? And Jamadagni says, first, I hate Kshatriyas. Are you a Kshatriya? And Karna's like, no, I'm a Sutta. It's cool. And Rama Jamadagni, equal opportunity employer, okay, you're with me then. Let me teach you everything I know. Rama Jamadagni was kind of like giving away his weapons because I guess he was kind of renouncing violence because he just like killed everybody and the gods begged him to stop and he's kind of feeling bad. So gives away all his weapons, and then Karna hears about that, and that's when he approaches him. Anyway, so Karna's studying with him, and then one particular episode, Rama Jamadagni lays his head in Karna's lap, and Karna, being the good student, does not want to disturb his guru while his guru sleeps. Indra, okay, mythological tension between the sun god and the storm god. Right? There's always tension between these guys. Sun god, or storm god, is the father of Arjuna. Sun god is the father of Karna. Explains the tension between these guys and why they want to kill each other and why they ultimately do, or at least why one of them gets killed. So Karna is sitting here with his guru. Indra basically makes a promise to Arjuna, long story, turns into this little worm and starts burrowing in the thigh of Karna so that he'll wake up his guru and piss his guru off. right? Karn's like, I'm gonna take it, and it's this grapple, like blood starts pouring out everywhere, it's like eating its way through his. Karna's like, I'm gonna take it. Jama Dugni's head is getting full of blood, and he wakes up and he's like, what the hell is all this blood? And Karna's like, yeah, just, you know, this worm eating in my thigh, I didn't want to wake you up. And Jama Dugni says, you're a Kshatriya. Nobody could endure that pain unless they were a Kshatriya. You are not a Suta. You lied to me. What am I going to do? Curse you! Right? So he basically curses him. He had given him this Brahmastra weapon for this very, very powerful. These are very like atomic-like weapons these guys are getting. And he says to him, he says, because you lied to me, when you need that weapon the most, you're going to forget the mantra for it. And what does Karna do? He starts saying, no, please don't do that. And he gives him something else. He gives him a bow instead. And he's like, okay, well, you can have my bow then. Sorry about that. He convinces him that he wasn't a Suta. He's like, no, I mean, that he wasn't a Kshatriya, that he was actually a Suta, a low-caste charioteer. So he becomes convincing. So he gets cursed there by Jama Dagni to not remember his weapon. At one point, he's training, kills a helpless cow. The cow curses him to die when he's helpless. That he will become helpless like that cow was, and that's how he will die. There's a second curse. Third curse is there's a little kid playing in the in the rocks with a thing of ghee and drops it on the ground. It breaks open. The ghee spills all over the ground. Karna, this big strong dude, picks it up, all the dirt, and starts squeezing it, and all of the ghee is dripping back out. You know, because he's separating the dirt, because the little kid's crying, and he's trying to propitiate the kid. He's like, here, no, okay, I'll make it okay, kid, just stop crying. So he's squeezing this earth, and all this ghee is like separating from the dirt, but he's squeezing that dirt so hard that Prithvi, the Mother Earth, starts screaming in pain, and he's, oh, what? He throws it back, and Mother Earth's like, you jerk, because you squeezed me so tight, I'm going to squeeze you that tight. So, on the battlefield in Kurukshetra, when he is in battle with Arjuna, his chariot gets stuck in the mud. Frozen, can't move. He jumps out of the chariot to free it. Can't move it because of the curse. He's standing there helpless because of the cow. He goes to remember his weapon, can't remember it. Arjuna and Krishna roll up in their chariot. Arjuna takes the bow, points it at Karna, about to kill him. Karna says, Dharma, rules of war. I am off of my chariot. You can't kill me. Right? Mm. Arjuna kind of looks over at Krishna. Krishna says, kills Karna. Right? So this is one of the examples where the heroes do adharmic behavior. They do wrong behavior to win the bigger battle because Krishna urges them to. That's why he gets cursed by Gandhari and eventually dies. So, not sure how much more of this I'm going to go through. So, Angie, if you could flip that. So that's Karna, and that's his curse.
Krishna actually reminded him of what had happened to Abhimanyu.
Okay. Yeah. So, anyway. I was just going to go another 5 minutes or so. Not much longer. Okay. Well, actually, this goes on forever, but... okay, so now all these kids are done training, right? They're done with their training. Now it's time Guru Dakshina time. It's time for Guru Sensei Drona to get his gift. What does he want more than anything? Remember that jerk who was his best friend who wouldn't help him out when he was poor? He wants them to bring him to him in chains. They go and they basically get Drupada. Right? First the Kauravas try and they fail. And then they send the Pandavas and the Pandavas actually go and get Drupada and bring him back in chains. Right? And what Drona says is, okay, you jerk. You said because I was not your equal, you wouldn't help me out, even though we were best friends when we were kids. I'm going to take half of your kingdom. And now we are equals. Right? And guess what? Now Drupada is pissed off. Cycle of violence, right? Drupada is like, okay, so now you took half of my kingdom and humiliated me. Now I need to kill Drona. So, you know, Drona's kind of appeased for the moment. He's like, okay, I humiliated this jerk who wouldn't help me out because, you know, etc. But now Drupada's mad because he's been humiliated. So he's decided he's going to have this yajna, this sacrifice, in which he's going to produce a child that will kill Drupada. Or, what am I saying wrong? Will kill Drona. So he has this yajna out of the fire. Again, womb birth. Out of the fire comes Dhrishtadyumna and Draupadi. Right? Draupadi, the daughter of Drupada. Okay? And Dhrishtadyumna is basically his inception is to kill Drona, okay, which he does. And then Drupadi, so this is all this sacrifice to kill Drona, and these two come out of it. And oftentimes, Draupadi, she marries the Pandavas. Oh, well, they all have a wife called Draupadi. She marries all five of them. Just very, very rare.
You're not going to tell the story?
No, we're out of time.
Oh.
Yeah. So she marries all five of these guys, right? And she's often blamed. Like, you know, just the kind of, like, narrative of the Mahabharata, it's kind of like she's the one who led to the war, which is kind of interesting. So she kind of gets a lot of the blame for this Kurukshetra war, this impending war that's happening. So basically, just to kind of sum things up and bring it to an ending, this conflict continues. These guys do bad things to these guys. These guys do bad things to these guys. They can't seem to work it out. The whole court becomes divided. Nobody's really sure who the heir of the throne is, and the war is pretty much inevitable. And I'll just leave it at that for now. We'll pick it up next week with the two exiles of the Pandavas, the dicing game, the Kurukshetra War, and then the after effect. Okay. So the latter half of this story will probably go quick. It's the building up to the war that I think is very, very exciting. The war itself, you know, we'll tell about how the characters die, and then the aftermath after that. You know, some stories of how Krishna dies, how the Pandava dies, and the Dharma tests that Yudhishthira goes through, etc. There's more to come. I hope you can all make it next week. Thank you very much.
What a performance. Amazing. Thank you so much. Well, there are there's a donation bowl over on the counter there. There are copies of the Mahabharata over there. There's an email list for Kojin's group that you can sign up for right at the door to the right here. We encourage you to come back next week. We encourage you to make contributions to help pay for all the energy and expertise assembled here tonight and produced for you all and us all tonight. And thank you so much for coming together.
Thank you very much.